Welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks with expert advice from Jim Lang, Pittsburgh-based CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert. Jim is also the author of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. To find out more about his book, his practice, Lang Financial Group, and how to secure Jim as a speaker for your next event, visit his website at paytaxeslater.com. Now, get ready to talk smart money.
Hello and welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm Nicole DiMartino, Marketing Director for the Lang Financial Group, located in Squirrel Hill. And as always, I'm here with Jim Lang, nationally recognized Roth IRA expert. Jim's a CPA, an attorney, and he has 30 years of experience. And he's also a best-selling author, as all of you know, of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. And as I announced on our last show, Jim is finishing his third book entitled The Roth Revolution. And this book is entirely dedicated to the Roth IRA, Jim's favorite subject. I've actually been reading it. I think it's excellent. He does an exquisite job covering every facet that you would need to know if you're considering a Roth IRA conversion. So definitely stay posted for that. Jim, I also want to congratulate you. Recently, you've been named one of Pittsburgh's 2010 five-star wealth managers.
Oh, actually, when you pointed that, I thought that was John Bledsoe.
No.
I did.
No. Recently, our office was awarded that, and I did some research, and I found out the award, it recognizes best in client satisfaction. So if any of our clients are listening out there, thank you so much for nominating us and supporting our win. So congrats. Congrats to you. Tonight, we're excited because tonight's show is live, and I'm going to give you that number right now. The studio line is 412-333-9385. Again, that's 412-333-9385. And tonight, we have a special guest, friend of the firm, John Bledsoe, on the phone with us tonight. John, are you on?
I am.
All right. Well, welcome back. I know you were on the show before.
Great. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, certainly. And before we get started, I want to give you the introduction you deserve. For everybody out there, John has 20 years of experience working as an estate planner and a financial planner for some of the country's wealthiest people. Matter of fact, he's considered an expert for the super wealthy. And actually, what I'm looking at here, although you can't see it, John has several designations after his name, a ton of them. I know we used to call it alphabet soup a long time ago because there's so many. But for those of you who don't know, if you're in the financial services industry, you can take additional training and specialize in different things. And once you get that certification, you earn a designation. John actually has six of them. He's a certified financial planner, a certified estate planner, chartered life underwriter, chartered financial consultant, and he's earned his master's in financial services as well. He's the best-selling author of The Gospel of Roth, which you can all get on Amazon.com, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But he's also a consultant for several large companies out there, insurance and securities related. So we have an expert, an author, a teacher, all-around friend of the firm. So does that cover it?
I think that maybe covers a little too much.
Oh, no.
Well, to be fair, also, what Nicole failed to mention is that you're actually one of the long-time retirement and estate and IRA and Roth IRA conversion experts. I mean, I remember that you were writing stuff back in the late 90s. In fact, some of the stuff, including you had an article called 10 Myths, was so good that back then I asked you if I had your permission to put it on my website. You said yes, and it's still there. Mm-hmm. So I really consider you a veteran Roth guy. And the other thing that I like about you is that you're not only a Roth guy. You know, you're not just like a one subject guy that like me, you use Roth IRA conversions as just one of, but not your only tool that you can help clients.
Absolutely.
So actually, with that in mind, what I thought we would talk about are, rather than just talk purely about Roth IRA conversions, which we did last time, and we're certainly going to be talking about that quite a bit, but what I thought we would start with is some of the combination strategies that you sometimes like to advise your clients, things that you might say, well, for example, let's do a Roth IRA conversion, and at the same time, I want you to XYZ. I actually have a chapter in the book that I'm writing right now called Complementary Strategies, and I have a case study where I'm recommending about six different strategies to do on top of the Roth IRA conversion. But I thought I would ask you some of the things that you like, because you are an overall planner. And by the way, a lot of those designations, they're not just, you know, random alphabet soup. You know, for example, CFP represents, I don't know, a couple thousand hours of work to earn that designation. But anyway, John, with that background, could you tell me about some of the combination things that you like to do in conjunction with Roth IRA conversions?
Well, absolutely, Jim. And I think you've got to take everyone's picture specifically and go down the line. What may be perfect for one person may not be for another, but people must continue to look at their own situation and make sure that the facts are aligned with their strategy. And so specifically, ignoring estate tax is very, very, very scary right now, because this year, as we like to say inside the business, great year to die, right? Because there's no estate tax. At least that appears to be the law of the land. But next year, the estate tax begins again. So people with larger estates, people with over $1 million or $2 million, need to be worried that that they need to plan their estate.
Yeah, I mean, that's such an odd thing, because last year I was telling people, oh, yeah, don't worry. You know, they're certainly not going to let it be unlimited in 2010 and then go back to $1 million in 2011. Certainly anybody with any sense or any Congress that even has a modicum of reliability and ability to get things done is going to pass some type of law, whether it's a $3.5 million exemption or $4 million, or I know recently was proposed to go from $3.5 to $5 million, but they didn't get it together. So now we're in this really odd quandary of unlimited this year. Of course, they could still pass a tax and have it go apply retroactively to January 1, and then $1 million next year. So that's a very tough question on how to plan for that.
Absolutely.
So anyway, what are some of the, do you have any specific things? Do you sometimes recommend life insurance and Roth IRA conversions?
Well, absolutely. If someone has a large IRA and during the conversion strategy, first of all, and I don't know if we still differ on this or not, but last time we talked, there was some concept to many of the listeners that I broached a long, long time ago, that the safest strategy is to convert first and ask questions later. Plan on unconverting all of your IRAs to from the Roth back if you want to, all the way up until October 17th of next year. But I can't imagine someone planning their situation without converting first to unconvert next year, or you won't have all the options. So I still believe it's a dangerous strategy to not convert, even if you're planning on unconverting at all.
Well, I do have a confession, John. I have moved. To me, you're like way on the extreme. I have moved much closer to you since we have last talked. And you're right, I was pretty cautious about telling people to basically, if I can paraphrase your strategy, although it's actually a common strategy, I wrote about it many years ago, as you did and other authors did, which is to separate your Roth IRAs into multiple Roth IRAs, convert all of your traditional IRAs, then separate the resulting Roth IRAs into different buckets or different accounts, if you will, and then consider recharacterizing them by October 17th. And I was a little bit leery of it, and I still am a little bit afraid of the mechanics, but I am more comfortable with that idea. So I will certainly grant you that. And certainly you and the other thing is, you were one of the very early guys talking about it, and it is becoming more and more common in the financial press also.
Well, thank you. And again, we're talking about October the 17th of 2011. The date, of course, is October the 15th. And I love the way our government works, that if a tax deadline falls on the 15th and it's a weekend, then you get to the following Monday. I learned through a very strange set of facts that it doesn't work that way if you owe a credit card bill over the weekend. Oftentimes paying it on a Monday doesn't count. Don't ask me how I found that out. But the government, being fair, allows you all the way until October the 17th, literally with a phone call. The trustees, on the morning of Monday, October the 17th of next year, will unconvert these accounts that have been converted to a Roth IRA. Yet you could be sitting next October of 2011, and say, my goodness, it would have been a good idea to have converted this one account. Can we go back and convert it? And what's the answer? Of course, no, you can't. If you didn't do it way back in July of 2010, you can't do it in arrears.
Yeah, and John, I'm sitting here smiling, thinking you really do like to live life on the edge, because to me, I would try to get all this stuff done by the end of September on the theory that, hey, there might be a last-minute screw-up, somebody might file the wrong form, there might be some issue, not to mention maybe somebody's on vacation. But you it seems that you like to live life on the edge.
Well,
convert everything now, or actually, better yet, January 4th of 2010, and then wait until the last minute to unconvert or recharacterize.
At least you need to know that you have that option.
That's fair enough.
And I probably will be unconverting the ones that are unconverted, unconvertible, as it were, before then. But absolutely, I probably do like a little bit more on the edge. I certainly like the ability. To me, it's if you don't convert now, it's kind of like not wearing your seatbelt, thinking I'm a safe driver, I'm not going to have a wreck. I think you got to convert now, planning on unconverting, because if we do have a wreck, taxes could go up substantially, even more than we know that they are, and other things could happen. And just in case, I think the safest position, even if the listener thinks that they're never going to leave any of it converted, the only position of safety, of flexibility, is to convert and then wait.
Well, I think that that is, I will admit I am moving closer to that position. I'm still not really even close to that, because I still think of other considerations. But I will admit that I am closer to that, and it's an interesting paradigm shift, because most people would assume I'm not going to convert unless somebody proves otherwise. And what you're saying is you should convert everything unless somebody tells you otherwise.
Absolutely. And a couple of very minor exceptions to that, but I believe that with all my heart. But that's what makes the world go round.
All righty. Well, anyway, we were starting to talk about some complementary strategies with conversions. And one of the ones that often comes up is life insurance. And I thought I would ask you what you sometimes do in practice with some of these combination strategies and, let's say, life insurance, for example.
Absolutely. Well, life insurance inside a trust for people who specifically, and I'm talking about life insurance now, no longer for protection. And I know there's a whole world out there where people need protection from life insurance, but my practice has been exclusively for people who are typically older and whose kids are grown and their net worth is now their protection. People that are often, for tax strategies, will put life insurance inside a trust that's not included in their estate, and they will buy a guaranteed death benefit where the life insurance, when it is paid, is, of course, income tax-free. One of the attributes of life insurance, the death benefit, is income tax-free, and it's also estate tax-free because it's held in one of these so-called trusts that's irrevocable, very hard for a Texan to say, but it's one that you can't change theoretically once you set it up. But built in with flexibility, you then have this money that's sometimes calculatable as a bond strategy that is superior to the CDs and bond tranche of the client's assets, those parts of the assets. So we're utilizing life insurance for people who typically are wealthier than $2 or $3 million. They may be $4 or $5 million in wealth, and it looks like their account values are going to stay the same or maybe go up slightly. We begin to use life insurance inside a trust. Typically now I'm very, very biased because of the low relative difference to buying a guaranteed death benefit, where the full faith and credit of the life insurance company, whether it's Prudential or New York Life or name the company, guarantees that if you pay X number of premiums in a certain amount, then the death benefit is also guaranteed for the life of the person, whether they die at 90 or 95 or 100 or beyond.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, I would second that. I do like guaranteed products, and I do like it. And in fact, it's an interesting analogy that you say that, that kind of replaces or substitutes the bond or fixed income element of a portfolio, because it does, under most circumstances, unless you live to, some of our calculations show, to age 98 or even sometimes beyond, that it tends to have a very high return on investment. Let me ask you this. I know that different people have different strategies. So, for example, Ed Slott likes to have life insurance on the primary IRA owner, and then after the death of the IRA owner, use the life insurance for the spouse and have some money going down to children and even grandchildren for the IRA and the Roth IRA. Is that a strategy that you like, or do you like a second-to-die life insurance policy, or are you going to be like an attorney and say it depends?
I guess I'll be a little bit. I hesitate to do that because normally, and I hate to admit to Nicole, I've actually withheld evidence. I probably have 15 or 16 of these designations. That,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's probably the sign of shortcomings in other parts of my life, and I wanted to keep up with Jim with smarts, but it's not going to happen. So what Ed Slott says, and he's got a lot of great strategies and a good friend of both of ours, Ed has a wonderful way of talking about this life insurance. You insure the big IRA account holder, and oftentimes the strategy would be when that account holder dies, then the IRA then you have the ability to convert it potentially, because of the liquidity event, to tax-free as a Roth IRA. The problem is that if the primary insured in that case on a single life policy doesn't die well into a short period after they're 70 and a half, it can be problematic. One of the things I point out in the book, The Gospel of Roth, is the half-life is under 14 years of an IRA once a person turns 70. In other words, if you could have had $2 million in IRAs by converting to a Roth before you're 70, by the time you're age 84, you'll only have $1 million in an IRA if you left it in a regular IRA and only took out the bare minimum, even if you're earning 9 or 10% a year in that IRA and taking out the minimums. And so I hate to say that it might be a bad part of the strategy is people not dying quickly enough, or sometimes in an irritating fashion, the non-participant spouse dies first, and which really kind of ruins the strategy, at least for that purpose. And so I tend to separate those two, even though I use it as combo strategy, Jim. I would oftentimes look at those numbers. Second-to-die life insurance is not cheaper. It appears to be cheaper. It's not always the magical product. What you have to look at is what would the cost of life insurance on either of the lives individually versus second-to-die. And we probably end up using it about 65% of the time for spouses who have the luxury of having a second-to-die policy. And the rest of the time, we'll use an individual life policy, but probably only about 50 or 60% of the time using the participant spouse. A lot of times the IRA holder is not as insurable as the other person.
All right, so actually, I don't know if it's coincidence, and we actually haven't talked about it, but one of my favorite strategies is a second to die, or sometimes a policy on the person who is going to have the longer life expectancy, which tends to be, at the risk of sounding sexist, but it tends to be the woman who tends to be either younger or the same age and just has a longer life expectancy according to the insurance tables. So I sometimes like that because I think you get a huge bang for your buck. Then what I sometimes do is that creates a pool of money for the children, and that frees up some money to have some IRA and, better yet, Roth IRA money go down to the benefit of grandchildren, or well-drafted trust for the benefit of grandchildren, in which case they can have many years of tax-free growth. And I don't know if that is something that, that you do also.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm a big fan, I think you have been for a long time too, these well-drafted trusts that you're very familiar with because you're drafting them, oftentimes give the children of the people who own the IRAs the ability to disclaim part or all of some of those IRA components, where they have the flexibility of making a game time decision after mother and father have both passed away of how much would be appropriate to go all the way down another generation through these one of these so-called IRA inheritance trusts. And I absolutely love that strategy.
Well, yeah, that's almost, well, in fact, I would say that that's my standard, for example. So even in our, quote, simple I love you documents, where we're leaving everything to each, to the spouses, each other first, and then to the kids, even if somebody doesn't say anything, I'm still going to have a well-drafted trust for the benefit of the grandchildren. And then, you know, when there is a death, or in the case of the life insurance, the euphemism, of course, is when the policy matures, then we can have money, then we can have the children choose whether they want to keep the money, or the legal word for disclaim it or say, I don't want it. And what I often do is there'll be multiple buckets of money. There might be some after-tax dollars. There might be some life insurance dollars. There might be some IRA dollars. There might be some Roth IRA dollars. So sometimes we like to mix and match after one or two deaths.
Right, and by building that flexibility in, and obviously, and I know in some of your documents, if you have the adult child, the 50-something, 60-something beneficiary disclaiming some of that money for his or her children, and that person, the 60-year-old beneficiary, gets to remain the trustee, the boss over that tranche that goes on down to the grandkids. That kind of softens the blow there too, to use a life insurance term. They say the death benefit softens the blow of death. I always thought that was a funny euphemism.
Yeah, and I like using the, let's say, the adult child as the trustee. So, for example, if I was to inherit some money and I chose not to accept it and I wanted it to go down to the benefit of for my daughter, I would want to have the ability to have the purse strings. Now, Natalie Schott warns that you can't use, you know, you can't just use that like a checking account, and you still have to use a certain amount of discretion as the trustee. But I do that in my documents too. So I will typically name the adult child as the trustee, and that would never happen if you didn't anticipate the probability or the possibility of a disclaimer, because a normal will or trust, for that matter, will say something like, well, if the adult child is deceased, then that money will go into a trust for the grandchildren. And then usually somebody else, like an aunt or an uncle or the surviving parent of the grandchild, but it doesn't take into consideration that the child is just fine but chose not to accept the money.
Right, and I think the distinction, Jim, is when the parents are deciding, okay, my 20-year-old daughter, I'm not disclaiming to her so she can buy a Corvette. I'm disclaiming into a trust fund for her where I can control the purse strings, and she will be able to have perhaps a nicer retirement as a result of this. It makes it an easier pill to swallow, and people, you probably see a high percentage, probably as much as half the people, utilize those trusts after mom and dad have died by disclaiming some of it.
Yeah, I'll tell you what the pattern that we have seen. Now, we've been in business 25 years, which is relatively young for a law firm because I started it myself. So, and we've done about 2,000 estate plans. So I've drafted an awful lot of them, but we've still had a couple hundred deaths. And here is the pattern that tends to occur over time. At the first death, we typically have money, if the surviving spouse does not want or need the entire amount, we typically have maybe some money going to children, but not typically grandchildren. Usually the children kind of take care of themselves at the first death, but then at the second death, that's when it is more typical that we find that money is being disclaimed to the grandchildren. But one of the things that I like about the combination of life insurance and that type of flexibility is that the life insurance would then create a pool of money, not potentially to pay estate taxes, but also, even forgetting estate taxes, to satisfy the spending needs of the children generation that allow the children to be more generous in disclaiming money to the grandchildren that will have many more years of income tax-free growth in the case of the Roth.
Right. One thing I would caution, Jim, on the analysis of the life insurance is that if the clients will look at it as a bond-type transaction as opposed to a liquidity transaction, particularly with second-to-die life insurance, understand that if the premiums were $10,000 a year for 20 years, that would be $200,000 of money out, and the death benefit is $500,000, that same $10,000 per year for 20 years would be worth $500,000 by most of the time, the second death, even invested at 5 or 6%. So it's not that the insurance is necessarily a windfall liquidity-wise. It's just after income tax, even 1 or 2% of guaranteed effectively better after-tax return is a magnificent thing when you're talking about a bond selection. It still is not a windfall. If you want a windfall with life insurance, it's similar to this year. You need to die sooner than later, which we've not yet met that person who's willing to make that commitment to their plan. I'm sure they're out there, but the throw mama from the train strategy is one that I would even agree is aggressive.
Well, you're right. And even using your example, if let's say that somebody buys one of these second-to-die policies, pays $10,000 a year, and then they and their spouse die 20 years later, and they have $20,000 out of pocket, and then their children get a $500,000 check, you would think logically that somebody should have to pay income tax on $300,000. And you would think logically that $500,000 should be subject to estate and state inheritance taxes. And neither is the case. That is, there's no income tax and there is no federal or state inheritance taxes on that money.
That is correct. And a good lobbyist for the life insurance industry would say, of course, if you put that same amount of money in tax-free bonds and it ended up being worth $500,000, it would be a similar thing. And you wouldn't want to tax the poorer people who needed that death benefit. And it's been a greatly preserved tax advantage. And one of the few reasons that we utilize it, but it certainly has, without that, it would lose a great deal of its luster, would it not?
Well, yeah, and particularly today. I mean, right now, you're not going to do very well on a tax-free bond. And I would say over the last 10 years, of all the investments that I can think of that I have, let's say, recommended for a client, I'd say that probably the second-to-die life insurance policies have probably been about one of the best investments.
Yeah, from a standpoint of relative yield, it's been phenomenal. It's a longer term, but its rate of return has been better as a compared to alternative investments. I agree with you than other strategies we've recommended.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think a lot of people that they really have to do when they if they get into one of these guaranteed policies, I think there is a history of people buying the policy and not necessarily finish paying it to term. And so let's say, for example, in the types of policies I like the lowest premium and the highest death benefit. But what you typically give up is a good cash value. So one thing, if one of my clients were to buy the type of policy I recommend, pay on it for 15 years and then stop paying after 15 years, the cash value would not end up being a good return. I think the insurance company knows a lot of these policies are not going to go to term, and they can actually put that in their pricing. So I would caution people, don't do it unless you are prepared to pay premiums the whole time. And accordingly, I don't like to do too much insurance where the insurance premium is going to be a burden. And I also like to leave money available for 529 plans and just straightforward money to the kids as they need it.
Well, you bring up a great point. Almost 90% of those policies, including second to die, do not meet the term, meaning that the clients don't die with the life insurance. And
did you say 90%?
90.
I never have heard that statistic. I knew it was high, but wow.
Well, guess what? If you were a life insurance company, you'd probably want to keep that statistic to yourself.
Well, I would, because if I'm the life insurance, And by the way, I'll tell you what that helps explain. That helps explain why, I hate to say it, but the life insurance is so cheap.
Oh, yeah, the rates of return. It's the same way, the same reason that a Sam's Wholesale Club or a Costco can sell a Chili's gift certificate for $30 for only $25, realizing that they made money on the card by selling it, so there's cost of that. The selling gift cards, selling long-distance cards, selling a basket of minutes where you use on your cell phone, these unused things like life insurance, are there where if the majority of the people cancel them, a lot of times because folks are very lucid and they buy these life insurance policies inside these irrevocable trusts at 70, but by the time they're 90, they've forgotten why they bought them, and they didn't apprise the trustee that this was real important that we pay all 20 years, and there's no one there other than a life insurance clerk in a home office who processes the paperwork, says, well, they say they want to cash surrender it.
All righty, John and Jim, we need to take a short break. All righty. And I want to remind our listeners out there that we are taking calls. You have Jim and John at your disposal here. If you have questions about Roth IRA conversions, the life insurance that they're talking about, feel free to give us a call. We also get a lot of calls if you want a second opinion on something you've already done. So we also take that. The studio line is 412-333-9385. Again, that's 412-333-9385. We'll be right back.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Welcome back to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm here with Jim Lang and John Bledsoe.
Okay, John, we were talking about life insurance. One other thing that I would want to mention, I'll give you a chance to comment on it and make any other comments before we go to the next topic, is I don't like when people get too much insurance to the point that either the premium becomes a burden to pay, or I'll tell you what I really don't like. I don't like it if there is a situation where children need money now and too much of the budget went to life insurance so the parents feel that they can't afford any more money going to a child as an as-needed gift. So I like to use the kind of like the three types of gifts, which is life insurance, and my personal preference under most circumstances is second to die on a guaranteed basis, low premium and a high death benefit, 529 plans, which are tax-free education trusts for children, and then straightforward gifts.
Right. I concur with that, by the way.
All right. Do you have anything else on life insurance or any other complementary strategies before we move on to some
No,
other
go,
areas?
Go ahead and go on to the next one. I think that's been pretty well exhausted there.
All right. Well, I'll tell you a couple of the things that I really liked about your book. And by the way, we haven't given a proper plug for your book. The book is The Gospel of Roth. It's just an excellent book that I can recommend to readers and listeners without question. And you can get that at Amazon.com. And, John, is it better if they get it through you or through Amazon?
Amazon.com is great. They've been selling a lot of our books. And the reason it's called The Gospel of Roth is my daddy was a preacher, and I thought it was a funny play on words that gospel means good news. So it's not a religious book. It is hardcover, but don't carry it to church with you.
Well, as long as we're going to get some religious overtones, how about if we talk about a few of your 10 IRA commandments?
Oh, I like that.
All right. I noticed on page 228, I'll tell you one of the things that I really like about your book that, frankly, you did a better job than I did, which is I have a lot of technical analysis, and I've tried to add a lot of stories to make it more readable and to make it more interesting. But what you've done sometimes on just a single page is you've just given some straightforward advice. And one of the pieces of advice that you gave was the 10 IRA commandments.
Ah.
And I don't know if you have a favorite one or if you want me to zero in on one of the ones that I wanted, but...
Well, I go ahead and tell me your favorite, then I'll tell you mine.
Well, one of the ones that I don't see in practice is... Now, some of them I think are so obvious that you would think that everybody would do them, like, for example, to contribute at least as much to your retirement plan as anybody would, as any employer would allow. That's your third commandment.
Right.
But your fourth commandment, and I don't know if it's necessarily so brilliant, but it's something that I see a lot of people that do not obey this commandment, and that is, thou shalt maximum non-deductible IRAs, then convert them immediately to a Roth every year. So let's say for discussion's sake that your income is too high to make even a Roth IRA contribution, not a conversion, but a contribution because you're still working. And we have a lot of listeners in that situation, but they still want to put money in their retirement plan, and they sometimes don't think of or they don't know about a non-deductible IRA. And given the right circumstances, that is, you don't have any other traditional IRAs around, you can convert them to a Roth every year.
Absolutely. And so even if you're making $1 million a year, you can still take another $5,000 if you're below 50 or $6,000 if you're 50 or above, and the same for your spouse. Make a non-deductible IRA contribution and then convert it to a Roth, therefore all the growth of that vehicle will be tax-free. And what's interesting to me, Jim, and you probably notice the same thing, the people that tend to have the most are the ones that take the most advantage of everything. And it's sort of like the people that come in to see you that are wealthiest are probably the quickest to say, how much is this going to cost me, Jim?
Well, I've heard that once or twice.
Yeah, and so the people that maximize their retirement savings, and $5,000 is a lot of money, and $6,000 is a lot of money, but if you've got a very big estate, it may not be that much. Yet the people that have done it faithfully, I've probably, like you, learned more from my clients than they've learned from me, watching these people save the money and watching them take advantage with some discipline of all these things. I think it's a terrific commandment, and I think a lot of people have done it long before you or I ever thought of it. And I like that a lot. Kind of in that same vein, I'll tell you, my favorite one is number 10. Thou shalt not incur penalties.
I don't like penalties, John.
I don't like penalties, whether it's with Chase Bank or whether it's with the IRS. And I make too big a deal sometimes over penalties, but I notice the really rich people, they don't pay interest. They don't pay things late. They pay them on time because they realize that these penalties eat you alive, and I don't like these tax penalties. And I think the message is, if you're below 59.5, seriously, if you're not 59.5 yet, and by the way, you probably can tell by how youthful my voice is, I'm a long ways from 59.5, almost 7 years from 59.5.
And if you saw your picture, you might think you're 30.
You might. Thank you, Jim. Well, you would absolutely have no business touching the money that you're using for your retirement when you change jobs or have a hankering to buy something, as we say down here in Texas. Don't do it. Just stop. Do not touch the money before you're 59.5, maybe even after you're 59.5, to go buy something. And it's just horrible to me, the large amount of people that have worked 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years for a company, for a school district or somewhere, and then they change jobs, they get a check in the mail for $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $11,000, and they put it in their checking account, and the money vaporizes, and they realize when they file their tax return the next year that, doggone it, not only did I have to pay income tax prematurely, I had to pay a 10% penalty. I just hate those penalties.
Well, I would agree with you. Before we get to one other commandment, there's one. I'd like to fill out the entire spectrum of what I would say is the best way to accumulate money for retirement, which is, number one, maximize what your employer is willing to match. Number two, if you have access to it, to put money into a Roth 401k, or if you work for a hospital or a nonprofit, a Roth 403b. That's another one that I often see people don't take advantage of that they have access to. Then, if there isn't a Roth 401k or a 403b, then contribute the maximum. Then do the Roth IRAs if your income is low enough. Then, if your income isn't low enough, then do traditional IRAs or, traditional 401ks, then do the non-deductible. I just wanted to complete that loop.
Okay.
All right. Is there another one that you wanted to talk about, when, as long as we're talking about commandments?
Well, it went along with this, and it actually got out. It would be the 11th commandment, so maybe this Moses lost a few of them along the way.
All right, well, what's the 11th commandment?
The 11th commandment would be, don't have any debt. Try to avoid debt at all costs, and as soon as you can get out of debt, for some of us, we were in the 40s when we got out of debt, but that's when we got really rich. If you want to say you're debt-free, you can't do it legitimately unless you've got everything converted to a Roth IRA. Because if you've got an extra $300,000 or $400,000 in a 403B or a 401K or an IRA rollover that's not a Roth, you're not debt-free yet. You've got a debt to the government on a commensurate amount of taxes against that. If you want to truly be debt-free, eventually have all your money converted to Roth IRAs, pay the taxes out of other funds, and you'll be totally debt-free.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. We got a call last week, and I'll give you the same question that the caller gave me. Guy named Ed from Florida, who has been following me, and he said all kinds of nice things about my book and my website, etc., said, hey, let's assume you don't have the money to pay the tax on the conversion. And right now, you know, you can borrow money pretty cheaply. So let's say that you're one of these guys that has a lot of your money in your IRA or your retirement plan, and you don't really have a lot of liquidity outside your IRA or your retirement plan. Maybe you have some equity in your home. Maybe you would be a good risk for a lending institution. He says, hey, how about if you borrow the money to pay the tax on the Roth IRA conversion? And well, rather than me telling you what I said, I think I'll just throw that one out to you, because...
Bet I know what you think, and I bet we're going to disagree again. That's more fun.
Well, that's okay. That's okay.
So, let me make up some facts here. Let's say, Ed from Florida. I've been to Florida a few times. There's a bunch of old people in Florida. Let's say Ed is over 59 and a half. Can we do that?
That's a good assumption.
Okay, Ed from Florida, over 59 and a half. You go with it, Ed, with this concept. Again, convert everything. Ask questions later. Your day to go firm on that is October the 17th of 2011. And as a matter of fact, your first day, if you want to be a great patriotic citizen, pay the least amount of potential taxes, this year the maximum bracket is 35% on a federal level. Next year it goes up, because the Bush tax cuts are over, to 39.6%. Therefore, if you've done your proper allocation of withholding, you really don't have to come up with the cash. Even if you're going to do it for this year as a conversion, it would be April the 15th of 2011. So if you're going to take a loan, don't be borrowing the money now, Ed. You need to borrow the money on April the 15th at the earliest of 2011. And if you want to take this advantage of this two-year no-interest plan the government's got, the old blue light special, the first time you're going to need to borrow half of the money, essentially, that you're going to pay in taxes, that is April the 15th of 2012. So if Ed has a large amount in CDs or bond-type investments that are relatively liquid, and they're paying 4%, and he's borrowing money around 4%, Ed is pretty safe on borrowing money next year, realizing that if interest rates go up, he can pull money out of his new Roth IRA conversion and pay it off. And that's one of the great myths that we'll get into in a minute. But so I think that for some people, it's a good idea. If Ed's young, if he's a Texan or from one of our real young states, then Ed could potentially look at this thing and say, I need to work extra hard and save money between now and April of 2012 so I can pay more of the money out of pocket and perhaps unconvert the rest and take it on a 3 or 4 or 5 year period to convert because I'm younger.
Well, it sounds like we're going to have to add a 12th commandment. There are exceptions to the first 11 commandments because you said don't borrow, and now you're saying it's okay to borrow.
I'm saying I don't like debt. I want you to be debt-free, but I'm saying a debt to Chase Bank, and this is not a Chase commercial, but we just had a national conference call with them. I'm saying a debt to Chase Bank is better than a debt to the IRA. Poor Ed's in debt, and he doesn't know it anyway. He owes the government. And so Ed's not debt-free unless he's fully converted. So maybe he's picking the lesser of two evils. And I don't like Chase at 12% interest, but I like him a lot at 4 or 5%. And Ed may be a good customer that gets a great loan, maybe even a home equity line of credit or something.
Well, we're going to take one more quick break before the end of the show. You're listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Alrighty, we're back, and thank you for joining us. We're talking to John Bledsoe. We're actually going over his Ten Commandments in the back of his book, The Gospel of Roth, that you can get on Amazon.com. And I think, Jim, you said you were making a 12th commandment before we left.
I think we already covered the 12th commandment, which is there's some exceptions to the first 11.
There may be many more commandments that we covered in the sequel and in Jim's book.
All right. You also have a nice kind of a catchy section on Roth IRA mistakes.
Ah.
And I thought that was a good one. I there's one or two that I like here, and I thought maybe I'd give you a chance to tell our listeners about one or two of your favorite mistakes, or either most common or the biggest.
Well, again, tell me while I find the page. Tell me the ones that you like.
All right. Well, I'll tell you the one that I'm writing about right now in the book that I'm writing about, which is, and I'm going to expand it a little bit. It says taking advice from the wrong people, and I'm going to expand that to be taking advice from the wrong people or using the wrong software program to calculate a Roth IRA conversion.
Ah.
And you know, I have, and I don't want to mention any big companies because I don't want to get sued, but there are some very big companies that are truly household names that have free or low fee, most of them are free right now, Roth IRA calculators on the web. And if you were to dutifully go through the questions that they ask and plug in the information that they ask for, you would get a completely different result than I would recommend. Even if we don't do this convert everything strategy, and we're going to use, let's say, a more traditional strategy of figuring out how much to convert. And I really have a major problem with a lot of the software. The other thing is, as you know, John, I run around the country giving talks to thousands of financial advisors, and sometimes the companies hire me for an all-day, 8-hour talk, but more often I'm speaking for an hour. And there's quite a few advisors out there who really don't understand all the concepts that I think are necessary to understand to really give people appropriate advice.
Yeah, it's a crying shame. In fact, as I go one step further, a Roth calculator run today cannot be right, period. It's broken. It can't work. We're speaking today in almost July of 2010, and we need to know a couple of things for sure to run a Roth calculator that's accurate. We need to know what the account level is next year around September, October of 2011. Has that account gone up or gone down? It was, if you converted it $100,000, is it worth $120 or is it worth $80? It means a big, big difference to the outcome. And if you don't know that number, and you can know it before you decide to convert and leave it converted, then you can't possibly have an accurate assumption. The other thing is, what are tax rates that are announced next year? What are they going to be prospectively? And again, you can't know that. Even the politicians don't know it. Every estate planner you and I knew missed this deal on it actually being free to die in 2010. We all thought the government was going to come in at the last minute like they do to keep the lights on, and they didn't because of political bickering back and forth, which has gone on for far too long. And in my opinion, these Roth calculators are a lot like looking at the almanac and planning your vacation because of the, you know, the specific week for the weather to not rain in a certain part of the country. Good luck to you, because predicting it more than 48 hours in advance on whether or not it's going to rain or shine is a little bit of a folly, and it perhaps is even worse with Roth IRA calculators. I think they're just wrong, and I think some of them are inherently mathematically incorrect as well. And I think that eventually, we're seeing our first class action lawsuits, by the way, arise where the people have made it so confusing for their folks to convert. It's kind of like that Bible analogy. They've given them a Gideon Bible with 1,100 pages in it, assuming that nobody was going to read it. And they give them these calculations, paralyzing them, as opposed to letting them convert some of their money to Roth IRAs and then letting them wait and see, and then next year decide to unconvert it where they have those options. If you get paralyzed by the analytical part and do nothing, you're far worse off. And you may be at a great time to convert now because your account may be lower than it was in January. You may have lucked out by waiting. But if you convert now, you'll have the ability to unconvert at today's level, which may prove to be a real bargain.
Yeah, the other thing that a lot of the calculators don't take into consideration is they measure in total dollars. So, for example, they would look at $1 million in an IRA as $1 million, and I would look at $1 million in an IRA as $1 million minus the taxes on the IRA when you cash it in. And if you use what I would call purchasing power as your measurement tool, you do a series of financial projections, that you will typically do a much greater Roth IRA conversion than if you are trying to use total dollars. So, for example, a younger person will have so many years to make up for the tax that they had to pay for to get a Roth IRA conversion if you measure in total dollars. But if you measure in purchasing power, what will happen is it will prove beneficial to older IRA owners.
Absolutely. And that's, again, one of the myths that you and I had a long, long, long time ago, and that is that the IRA statement is not indicative of your purchasing power. It's the gross amount. So if you've got $100,000 on your statement, in an IRA, you don't have $100,000 you can spend. You've got $100,000 minus your tax bracket, say $70,000 that you can spend. The purchasing power needs to be ferreted out, and so you can compare the apples to apples when you look at your situation, decide whether or not you should leave some converted or not, or planning your own retirement future.
Yeah, and I noticed that you have an interesting analogy in your book, and that is that with a Roth IRA conversion, you are in effect buying out your partner, Uncle Sam.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
I like that because much of these hedge funds have been castigated by charging the 2 and 20 and the usury type rates against the investor's money. Well, Uncle Sam is just as bad. Uncle Sam is saying, don't convert today, Jim, if you don't want to. It's no big deal. We own 35% of it now, and if we go up on tax rates in the future, we'll own a bigger percentage. And if you double or triple the value of your IRA, will own a bigger percentage then. It's almost like doing business with those mafia people that, of course, don't exist anymore, but they used to.
Certainly not in Texas, right?
I'm even afraid. I would couch that with, I'm just joking if you're listening out there.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to close the show, John.
If I'm in a wheelchair next time, Nicole, I want you to feel sorry for me.
Well, I'll certainly know what happened.
Absolutely.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us this evening. John Bledsoe, the author of The Gospel of Roth, you can get that on Amazon.com. Just as a reminder, if you want to hear the show again, it will replay Sunday morning at 9 a.m., and then it will appear on RetireSecure.com. if, like I said, you want to see Jim, but we're not having the workshop in July, you can certainly hop on retiresecure.com and you can get that workshop for $97. We'll see you again in 2 weeks. We'll be back with another live show. We will be hosting Natalie Schott, author and Boston-based attorney. Thank you for joining us. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, John. And you've been listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Good night.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Portions of the audio that you just heard will be posted online at retiresecure.com. You can also find a list of upcoming events and topics at retiresecure.com. To seek Jim's advice personally or to speak to a member of his dedicated staff at Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, call 412-521-2732. Join us again in 2 weeks when we talk more smart money.